It's 7 p.m. Thursday, and this is All About Wine. With All About Wine's resident wine expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the France. So we're continuing with France. Tonight. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport Mass.
Haverhill.com. The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com. In Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery. New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
India Vineyards on Route 93 at the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Bebach Winery.
We are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Cushu Park in Montana.
Famous Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
All right, grab a phone and let's talk about wine tonight. Dial area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. All right, let's start the show and let's talk about wine.
Yes, here we are again tonight. Hope everyone had themselves a wonderful... Thank you, bus people. Hope everyone had themselves a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday week. And everybody's back to work now. The roads are packed. The kids are back in school. I don't know about all of you out there, but the kids were off school all week for Thanksgiving this past week, which is very unusual. So we're all back in school. Mike is not feeling well tonight, so you've got me alone. Mike is got some bug, but there's a couple of nasty bugs going around anyway. So I don't know what it is that he is being infected or being attacked by, but... our best go out to him. Get well, Mike, and want to get you back on the program. So we have a guest tonight. Tom, I hope, is going to be our guest tonight. I've been corresponding with Tom. Tom's supposed to have been our guest a couple of weeks ago. And as you know, if you listen to the archives, we end up doing a generic program of a whole bunch of other stuff, which is always good because I always have things to talk about and I always have things that I can pass on to you. But Tom's supposed to have been on a couple of weeks ago. And we couldn't get a hold of Tom. Well, Tom got in touch with me the next day and says, oh, no, I left my phone in the car. I forgot all about it. I was moving stuff in. And then a few hours later, he remembered and realized. So, hey, we can forgive him. That's no problem. We've all done that. So we do have Tom tonight, I hope, I guess. I figure I've been corresponding with him, and he is ready and willing and able to come on and join us tonight. So I haven't talked to him today since he left his phone in the car again. But I left a message for his wife, and he said that's the way to get him to, you know, listen to stuff, tell his wife. So I did, and so it looks like Tom's going to be joining us. Well, so I'm going to leave for a second here and go try to get Tom onto the program. Mike usually takes care of this part of the show, and I'm going to be bumbling around a little bit here, so I hope I know what I'm doing, and I hope I'm doing it right. But while I'm away, I've got some real nice music for you to listen to, so this is we'll be back as soon as I get a hold of Tom and bring him on the show here.
Enjoy this Verizon ringback tone while your party is reached.
Hello? I'm on hold. Music's playing.
Is this Tom? Hello, Tom. Can you hear me? Oh, I just lost you. Well, let me try again. I'm back on with you people here. I'm sorry. For some reason, he disappeared. Let's see what we can do.
Back zone while your party is reached.
Oh, music over music. I haven't done this before.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. You there?
Yes.
Oh, very good. All right, this is Ron.
Good. You're on my schedule.
Yeah, good. I don't know why we got disconnected on that call beforehand. Probably because I was playing some music, and then when you go on hold, it plays music also, and it really confused me. And so, I'm glad you're on.
Yes,
so,
I am.
I haven't introduced you officially to anyone yet. I've been talking, but this is Dr. Tom Cottrell. He is with the University of Kentucky Extension in Lexington, Kentucky. He's an immunologist there. And from what I understand, when we talked to Diane and Rex Reed way back on, back on the 8th of this month, they said that Tom has been a great influence on them and helped with them. And they've also said that Tom knows a lot about wines and highly suggested that he be on the program. And so therefore, you are.
So I have them to thank, do I?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. They were the ones that suggested and said, get a hold of him. They gave me your number and everything. So
good. Good. Well, they've come a long way. They're actually making some very nice wines now.
Are they really? Yeah. A lovely couple. I enjoyed talking to them. It was really funny because before I get on the program, I got a hold of them, and they said they'd be on the program. And Diane says, I don't know if we have enough to talk about. And I said, we'll just talk. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
We got a hold of them about 7:05, and I had to say, hey, the program's going to go dead in 5 minutes. And that was an hour and a half later. So,
they
had plenty to talk about. So, Tom, tell us what I understand you have helped vineyards around the world. You have, or in the United States at least, you have, you are very involved with the grapes and all that. Tell me about yourself, if you will.
Well, I'm essentially the inside guy. I'm not, I know about vineyards, but my expertise is primarily once the grapes get there, I know what to do. I have clients that range from Quebec to Florida to Nevada. Nebraska starts with the same letters, and people in the Finger Lakes, the Pennsylvania, Vermont. So there's a lot of people, and I function as their offsite winemaking reassurer. Generally, they know what's to be done, and they say, "Well, can I do this?" And I can say, "Well, what's the situation?" And yes or no, and yeah, that's a good idea or not. Yeah. So I have a lot of fun.
I see. So you tell me your background then to be able to do this.
Well,
what did you do?
Well,
to
I was. Oh, I'm not sure. I studied physics in college.
Physics?
Went to work for DuPont and found out that everybody there had an advanced degree, even though I was making more money than some of them. Whoa, well, I figured they were going to cut me off and I figured I ought to get an advanced degree, and I took some more physics. And my mentor headed for Texas Tech, and I wasn't ready to go there. So I wound up in Rochester at the Optics Institute, where my PhD was in laser optics.
Oh.
Took a job in California doing research for a company that some of you may know, Spectrophysics, who does most of the scanning machines now. Very active, aggressive group of people, and they didn't really want me to do research. They wanted me to fix the stuff they were shipping out the door that didn't work quite right. So I am not bad at that, but every time I get something done, they'd say, oh, okay, now come over here, get work on this problem, and it's due yesterday. And I figured I would not live to age 37, So looking for something a little more cyclic, got in the wine business in the Napa Valley.
Ah. So your physics gave you a background in wine?
Well, it actually did. I learned winemaking from the then 39 wineries in Napa Valley. Only one didn't have time to explain it, all their stuff to me. But 38 people went through their whole routine on every step. And I would say, well, why do you do that? Uh-huh. And if they had a good answer, I'd say, oh, that's good. If the answer was Uncle Harry always did it, I could draw a line through it. So yeah. The physics background helped me think about cause and effect a little bit. So that was good.
Yeah. I always say this over and over to people, too. We in the wine business love to talk about wine. And it's something when you start asking people to tell you about stuff, they will tell you and tell you and tell you. And it's just.
Oh, yes. It's like asking you about your children. Oh, my gosh. Don't do that.
Exactly. Same thing with wine people. You ask them about wine and they'll just go on and on and on. I know.
Right.
So you started in Napa Valley in California. And then that led to what?
Well, I founded Cuvaison and it turns out, I thought it was 70, but it turns out we took out the papers in 69 and got that going and had a partner that was not a good partner. So I sold out in 75 and actually got into some computer stuff at that time. Computers were just coming on and had fun with programming. And then I decided, well, I'll go back into biz. Well, it's hard to go back into biz having been a winery president, you know. So where do you start? Well, I found a place to start, and that got things going, and a few more opportunities came along. Pretty soon, Gary Andrus came along and asked me on a Friday if I'd have time to talk to him, and the guy I'd been working for had just canned me because he thought his girlfriend had, you know, cozied up to me, which she had not. So that was on a Friday, and then Gary calls on a Saturday and says, you got time to talk to me on Monday? And I thought about it for a microsecond and a half and said, yeah. And so Pine Ridge is a fact, and he went on to other things in Oregon. Great skier. I went skiing with him, and he said, let's go down the hill. And he just got small. I mean, he became tiny.
Yeah, that's. Did you then? How long did you work with him?
Well, I got it started, and we had a no fault disengagement, and I disengaged. He and I had slightly different business practices, and I figured I should do that. So shortly after that, Cornell was putting out feelers for somebody to come and be a professor there at the Geneva station. And I didn't quite fit their description. So it took me about a year and a half to get them to fit their description to me, and I took the job. And so I was there from 82 to 86 and had a lot of fun because it was near my hometown of Ithaca. It was Geneva, New York, at the north end of Seneca Lake.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Ithaca is to the south end of Cayuga Lake. So we had a lot of fun with that and helped a lot of Finger Lakes wineries get going and do it right. And then I left to go to Chalk Hill Winery in Sonoma. And they were doing about 14,000 cases a year, which still is a small winery. Right. 4 years later, I left and we were selling 65,000 cases a year. So
wow.
I did some good for that guy. And I went to Rhode Island to a winery named Sahonet in Rhode Island doing 12,000 cases. In 4 years, I had them doing 35,000. I think they're still about 30,000 cases. Yeah. So, and then
wow.
I thought I retired. And the people in Kentucky were given tobacco money before the turn of the century. Isn't that a wonderful phrase?
Right. Yeah.
At the turn of the century, 98, 99. But they didn't have anybody that knew anything about grapes, so they planted Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Chardonnay, and Vidal.
Uh-huh.
In 2004, they had Vidal. because it's too cold to do some of those things unless you're on the right spot.
All right, and they froze, yeah.
They froze, so they didn't have them. So they also called me in 2005 and said, well, we've got people are growing grapes, but we don't have anybody that knows how to make wine. Can you come down? And I did. And so I've been here since 2005.
Oh. So you're working with UK then?
Oh, I am, yes. Yeah. My job is, simply put, is to help Kentucky wineries make consistently good wine. And I think I have had some successes. Right.
Well, fantastic. You said you help wineries throughout the country. How did that come about?
It's a spillover from the late 90s when I was living in New York State and sort of consulting for various wineries. I don't know if you're familiar with many in New York State.
The program covered New York for about 2 months, and so we talked to a lot of wineries and about wineries and all that. So, yeah, quite a few up there.
Yeah, Shelburne Point was fun for me because as a 9-year-old, I'd gone to camp there.
Uh-huh.
So that was fun. So they're going. They're doing all right. I was a brief connection with Hazlitt's 1852. At that time, I was, in addition to consulting, I was selling barrels and labels and whatever. And Hazlitt was doing 700 cases a year of Red Cat, mm-hmm. which is a red Catawba that's fairly sweet. It's like
a fairly dark
white Zinfandel. It's not really white. It's pretty red Catawba. So it's called Red Cat, I think. And that was 700 cases back in the late 90s. They are now doing 250,000 cases of that one wine.
Wow.
Is that wild? You get a recipe that works, do it.
Good, I know. Well, and not that, Lake Ridge Winery here in Florida, I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No.
But Lake Ridge Winery, and they are a competition, but hey, we all help each other, it seems like, all the time, so I don't mind talking about them. But Lake Ridge Wineries found their niche, too. They use the Muscadine grapes down here, and they make a sweet red and a sweet white from the Muscadine. Mm-hmm. And
Noble, and something else, right?
Yeah. People walk in there and fill up a wheelbarrow, 3-4 cases deep and high, and wheel it out to their car. They sell a ton of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
What's
the bottle price, or do you know that?
I think it's around $6, something like that.
Yeah, that's a giveaway. You got to do it. You've got to take it by the case. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a nondescript sweet wine, and people love it. It really,
The whole thing in this business is to make a wine that tastes good. Yeah. Don't give me anything about it. It looks, it's the right color, it's whatever. It's got to taste good. You can have a lot of other things wrong with it, but the good taste will throw it out the door, send it out the door, yeah.
Yeah, and, it's funny. I teach a class. One of the first things I tell in the class, we all sit down, and I start the class by saying, there are two types of wines in the world, the type you like and the type you don't like.
You're right.
That's it. You can go home now.
I empower people by saying to them, if they like the wine, it's good. If they don't like the wine, it's not good.
Yeah.
And you don't have to agree with each other.
And that's just it. I mean, if everybody liked the same, you can make the perfect wine. Every winery can make the perfect red, white, and blush.
Mm-hmm.
Or rosé. According to standards, according to our testing equipment and everything, everybody can make the perfect wine. But, why?
Not everybody wants the perfect wine.
Yeah, that's just it, And so, and who's to set the standards of what is the perfect wine anyway? So,
Well, we've got a couple of nabobs that would like to say they know, but I don't think they do.
Yeah, I know. Some of the wines that you find around the world too, and I'm worldwide. Some of them are so I don't know, hype. I think is funny because I had a professor at University of Florida And he said, "There's what's the biggest thing about wine that that you find everywhere?" And we were guessing all sorts of stuff. And he goes, "Nope, it's hype." He said, "That's the biggest thing about wine is hype." He said,
I don't sometimes use the expression BS, but hype sounds better.
but, you know, and it's the same thing. And there are some wines around the world where you think that there's just so much BS associated with it that, you know, it can never live up to its expectations or its whatever they're trying to do with it. And that's sad because I think this turns people off.
Well, people have to be the ones that decide whether the wine tastes good. And reading somebody's column where such and such a wine tastes good to them is no proof. If you might not like the wine, and you may know that you won't like the wine.
And it's like descriptions on bottles. I tell people, I said, don't buy a wine based on the description. You know, because, you know, I mean, I love the flowery descriptions that they put on some of these bottles. It just, it's phenomenal. And then people say, well, I don't taste this, I don't taste that, I don't taste this. And they think there's something wrong with themselves. And I said, no, there's nothing wrong with you. It's just, you know, if you don't, that's okay. If you don't detect all this stuff, you know. But it's funny. It's funny how the hype is ruled wine so much. It just, it's, well,
it's
not funny. Ha-ha.
It's overbearing.
Some
of the, one of the words that has been used to describe Cabernet is, oh, it's got hints of cassis.
Yeah.
You know anybody that's drunk cassis?
No.
I had it once, and I thought, I hope I don't see this in my Cabernet again. Right.
I know what you're saying there, and a lot of the descriptions and stuff. I it's almost funny.
It is funny.
One of the things I try to promote on this program is that we're trying to make wine more friendly and less intimidating. So all these descriptions, all this stuff, tends to lead to making wine intimidating. And it's not. It's just, it's to be enjoyed. And if you don't detect cassis in a wine, that's okay. You know,
maybe you don't want cassis in your wine. We don't know.
Most of the time you don't.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying. I get on a rant when it comes to some of that stuff like that, because I think people are afraid to try different wines because of that, and they're afraid to make comments about it, and afraid to say that they don't like it, because you're supposed to look at this. This is a $60 bottle of Cabernet with, you know, hints of cassis, so you should like it. You know, but
I did a tasting in when I was working with Chalk Hill. It must have been 84, maybe 85, and it was 82 high-end Bordeaux's. Mm. And we did a vertical, I guess, price-wise, of 82 Bordeaux's. And we had inexpensive wholesale prices at only $14 a bottle wholesale. And then we got up to 30, and then we got up to 60. And the last one, the wholesale price was 140.
Wow.
In the first case, there were no bad wines. All good. Second case, there were two bad wines, and it got worse. The top highest priced wines had more terrible wine than anything, which sort of says, quality and price might not be might not go together.
Yeah, and that's it. I'm on a lot of blog sites that I follow, and I keep track of in wine, and there's a lot of them out there, but I follow quite a few of them. And one of them, a question that's been popping up, does price dictate the quality? And
In people's mind, yes.
Yeah. Most of the time people say, no, not really, because there's other factors that are involved in there. It's not just price that dictates quality. And but it's been bouncing around. The site's been bouncing around with people, you know, trying to justify the prices of stuff. And you can understand why some things cost so much. I mean, you know, a ton of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes in Napa Valley is going to run you, what, $5,000 a ton now, whereas you can go to Fresno and get the same, you know, ton of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes for what, 900?
We can get it delivered in many of our southeastern states for 900 a ton, yes.
Yeah, delivered. Yeah, like you said. So, yeah. So when you start spending, $5,000 a ton for Cabernet Sauvignon, you're not going to be able to sell that wine for $14.95. I mean, it just...
That's right. It's just not going to happen. Right.
And yeah. So these are things that people need to realize, too, that, price is often dictated by, where the grapes are coming from, and if you're aging them in oak for 3 days or 5 years or whatever, so.
Right. All those things play in. And the thing that interested me lately was that several people have done tastings where they said, okay, the three on your right are all $30 or more, and the three on your left are all about $10 now. Which wines do you like? And they all like the $30 wines, even though it might be the same. So if you think it's expensive, you tend to think it's good.
Yeah, and that's true. I don't know. It's one of my pet peeves in the fact that price is one of the things that really sways people so much in wines, because you can find some very nice wines in the $15 to $25 range that will, blow away some wines in a higher price range.
Absolutely. I don't think there's a strong motive to get out of that range.
No.
We had a quick story about a winery in Kentucky. They had about 400 cases of a reserve Cabernet, and they released the first 200 cases and sold it about $25 a bottle. And it was pretty good wine, and it sold a little faster. They said, well, when we release the second, let's raise the price to $35. Well, it sold faster. That's called price inelastic. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's a good idea.
I helped a friend of mine in the Napa Valley in the late 70s. He had a couple pallets of a Zinfandel. It was getting a little old, and he had it on the floor back in those days for $4.50, and it didn't sell. I said, David, raise the price to $8. Say only three to a customer. It was gone in 2 weeks.
That's great.
I hate to give all the secrets. I don't know what our radio audience is thinking. Wait a minute.
A minute now. When I go out there, I know. That's great. Yeah. And that's, you see that often, though. I mean, it's not something that's really a big secret. You notice some wines will jump up, and then all of a sudden they will hit their maximum sustainable point.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody buys it, so they drop it down a couple bucks, say, on sale, and drop it back down to where it was before they jumped it up there, and then people start snatching it up again.
And the only three to a customer is a real hook.
That's a good one. I never thought of that, but that's great. I like that one. We are running short. Only three.
Yeah, only a few left. Better get. It's like a used car salesman,
Yeah,
And there's not very much written on quality and quality price. One of the things that was very, very amusing is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. It has a very long dissertation on why you think things have quality and therefore are worth a price. And it didn't have much to do with motorcycle maintenance or Zen, but it was very interesting. And in the 80s, that was the first thing that had been written about quality.
I never heard of that. Is that a book or a publication or?
It's a book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The writer actually did a trip with his son on motorcycles, and they took turns fixing it and talking about Greek gods and stuff. Very entertaining.
Yeah. I'll have to check that out. Zen, as in Zinfandel, or as in.
Zen as in Eastern religion, yeah.
Eastern Zen,
And the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
I'll have to check that out. So you tell people, they call you with problems and stuff. What type of problems? I mean, I'm not asking you to tell any particular wineries and stuff, but
there are not too many problems that face these people, and I can talk to them on the phone. I can go see them. I can come taste their wines, but there are some stabilities that we want to achieve in wines. Heat stability. We don't want cloudy wines from protein hazes forming. We don't want crystals in the wine. And how you avoid those things is well documented. And generally, I've explained it to everybody, but they don't remember well enough. So I get called in a lot. They say, why have I got this cloudy stuff? What is this stuff in my bottle? Well, and I explain it to them and I tell them how to fix it. And so that's one area, the stability problems. And then the other is the use of sulfur dioxide. And you've got to use enough sulfur dioxide to keep your wine from going over the hill or getting vinegary or going to sherry or something else when you want it to be a nice table wine.
Right.
So there's a lot of energy that I spend on getting people to understand the use of sulfur dioxide and the use of sorbate. And if you're doing all these sweet wines and you don't have a sterile filter, sorbate prevents yeast from budding. And 99.9% of the people cannot detect sorbate. So why don't we use it? Well, okay, most people do. And that really keeps a sweet wine sound. So making sure that people understand that and the fact that you've got to stir the tank before you bottle. And some of those things are like trivial, but they keep popping up. So, but it's that level of reassurance and making sure they're doing the heat studies and the cold stabilization for enough time and that kind of thing. I would like to get into a little more control over the nuances of the wine, but we're at the point in the industry where making a sound wine is much better than making one that's got a slight nuance to the right or to the left of last year's wine.
Yeah, well, that's very true. Yeah. And the question arises too, will people notice the difference in those nuances?
That's the hard part, yes. And Kentucky, like many other states, it's not a Kentucky problem. And New York has the problem. It's not a problem. It's the people generally, the man in the street, has not much wine experience and likes a sweeter wine.
Yes.
So we do have people coming into the industry with a little bit of money, and oh, they just want to do, you know, dry cab and a dry chard and something else. You're not going to sell anything. Mm-hmm. So we break the news to them, and pretty soon they come up with a blush or something that works. Yeah.
And it's funny, you mentioned that I had a Frenchman come into the winery, and my wines are not really dry. Most of them tend to be, you know, a little bit of residual sugar. I've got some, but even my dry ones aren't real, real dry. And he turned his nose up at all of them. He says, if I had a winery, I'd make these real heavy, bold wines. And I said, yes, you probably would. I said, and then as people came in, taste them, and left with no bottles, you'd be running out the door with them and saying, I'll add sugar. Because what people want. They don't like to, you know, overall people, and I've talked to wineries around this country, and everybody says the same thing. You know, there are those who like the bold wines, but overall people aren't a big fan.
It's not quite a 1% thing. It's probably a 10% thing. 10% of the wine drinkers have enough experience with wines to want a drier wine. I feel a drier wine is what I want to have with a meal. Now, the sweeter wines, I'm happy to have them on the porch, you know, at 5 o'clock. That's fine.
I want to back up on something here, too. You mentioned sulfur dioxide. Explain to people who are listening to this, and we get a lot of listeners, explain to them that sulfur dioxide and sulfites, the difference, because immediately people might
the sulfites generate the sulfur dioxide. Now, I want to put to rest the concern that people have, I get a headache from the sulfur dioxide. No, you don't. You get a headache from the histamines in wine. I did a fairly broad study at Cornell on histamines in wine, and reds have generally more histamines than whites, but some whites can have a whole lot. But it gives you a headache. So if you're getting headaches, take an antihistamine before you go taste wine.
I tell people that all the time. I didn't realize some whites had that much histamine, though. I always thought it was basically the reds.
Well, it is basically the reds, but some whites have more of the histamines than any red. I mean, it just was frightening. Fortunately, that particular variety did not catch on, so maybe we don't have to worry about it. But we couldn't really identify histamines with a particular variety, a particular yeast. It was just fairly random, but they're there. Yeah,
I know. I've told people that all the time. They'll come in and they'll say, well, I'm allergic to wine. I said, what are you allergic to? And they'll say, oh, I'm allergic to sulfites. And I said, so you can't eat or drink anything that you buy in the store? Well, no, I don't have a problem. I said, well, then you're not allergic to sulfites. You know,
I'll give you two quick stories. Watterson, the chair of the department in Davis, did a study on people and got 24 volunteers. He said the problem is the people that say they have sulfur dioxide reactions will never volunteer for a study. So he got 24 random people and gave them three times as much sulfur dioxide in their wines as you would normally expect, like 200 parts per million, maybe even 300 parts.
Wow.
Two people out of these 24 had brief, non-lethal asthma attacks for a few minutes, but nobody got a headache. Wait a minute.
and I don't think tannins, people say they get headaches from tannins. I don't think there's ever been a study that has proven that tannins give you headaches either.
I think you're right. I did figure out what gave us headaches. In the Napa Valley, we had pretty big picnics after a harvest, you know, and everybody'd bring wine, and we'd eat a lot of food and drink up all the wine. And the only thing left to drink was Olympia beer. And I knew it was the Olympia beer that gave me the headache, right.
Which is not endorsing or not endorsing Olympia one way or the other, but...
No, it's just pointing a finger at me, yes.
and it's just... have you heard the... it's been kicked around Congress a few times about having wineries add contains allergens to the wine label.
Gee, I hope not, because that would be extremely expensive to check that out.
And it'd open up a can of worms. So it's based on the fact that some wineries will use egg whites or fish oil or you know things like that to clarify the wine.
These are generally regarded as safe.
Yes, but some people are allergic to eggs, some people are allergic to fish, and so therefore the government and their infinite wisdom is thinking about, and it's been kicked around off and on over the years, of making wineries add contains allergens to the label, just like it says contains sulfites.
Well, the problem is it's going to be on every bottle, so yes. They'll never know what they could drink or not, which is a problem.
And
it's like the GMO thing. It says may contain GMO products.
Right. You don't know.
It'll be on everything, and you will never know which has got them. Right.
Yeah. And it's just, like gasoline, may contain up to 10% ethanol. We see that on all the pumps down here in Florida. Well,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. We take a moment here for all of us to scream.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I'm sorry. I backed up there on that sulfur dioxide because there's always an issue about that, and people always are talking about that. But clarify something for me, if you know, and I'm not sure. What is the maximum amount of sulfides? I understand by law it's 250 parts per million, but I read somewhere where somebody said 350.
350 is it. Yeah.
350 is the maximum?
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And that's measured total SO2. One of the things about SO2 is that the amount you need to be an effective antimicrobial thing is a function of pH. As the pH goes up, you have less of the active killer, which is called undissociated, and so you have to have more free SO2. And a lot of wineries are scared to use 100 parts per million free SO2, but that's what you need when you have a pH of 3.9 or 3.8. So making sure people are comfortable with that is one of my efforts also.
Yeah, because people are scared of it. I mean, wineries are scared to add it, and it's just and I think it's because it has that little warning on the bottles, and people are always, you know, oh, wow, I'm allergic to sulfite. Look at that. It says so right on the bottle, and it's
right
almost
on the bottle.
Like
we
blame everything on it. I kid and I joke and I say, well, you know, we're in a recession, but, you know, that's why, because wine contains sulfites. It says so right there.
Must be a direct connection there. Right?
It has to be, because it's right on the bottle.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost that silly, because some people just see it there. That's why thinking about adding contains allergens to the label. Oh, my, can you imagine?
I don't think it's going to help the people that are susceptible to allergens, except they will not drink wine. Okay.
That's what's going to happen, too. But if anybody gets any type of reaction to anything that they're having to eat and they have wine with it, then they're going to blame the wine. So.
That's right. That's right. Some people are very allergic to shellfish. And often in restaurants, you'll get a little shellfish broth in some soup or something. That would just put the wineries at great risk, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so, too. And it's been defeated over and over again, and saner minds have prevailed. And let's hope that it continues to do so that way. But every once in a while I pop up. I've talked to the president of FreeTheGrapes.org, and I talk to him quite often, and we keep up on it. And he said that, you know, once something like that starts popping up, he said they jump on that faster than anything. They realize the implications of something like that.
I was in the biz when asbestos was discovered to be a bad thing. This asbestos in filter pads is 3 to 4 inches long. You could never get it in your lungs. But the wisdom of the Wine Institute was to say, well, no, let's be the good guys and ban it. Okay, so we no longer have filter pads with asbestos in them. Well, okay. But it was a very effective filtration device. But
yeah.
So there you go.
And it probably was so minute that it wasn't making any effect.
Well, it's the little particles that hurt you that can get by all the hairs in your nose and stick in your lungs. But the things that are 3-inch, 4-inch long hairs don't get in your nose.
No, those are the ones you need to worry about. So you were talking about stabilizing wines and stuff like that, and people are, you know, do you have... questions are, do you run across situations on bottling?
I would say what I'm really working on in the last 6 months of conversations is getting people to test their wines before putting it in the bottle, so that you don't get it in the bottle and say, oh, wait, this has proteins in it that cause a haze. So there's easy ways to do it. You warm a bottle at 120 degrees for 3 days. And set it aside, let it cool. If it's clear, you're good. If it gets haze, you can fix it with bentonite. So it just doesn't make any sense. People think they've added the right amount of bentonite, but they don't stop to check the wine because they've added the number of pounds that they know will do it. Well, my life's not like that.
Nothing's cut and dry. Yeah.
We don't have a good check for cold stability, but if you have really held the wine at 28 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 weeks, it is cold stable. So I emphasize that you got to keep it down there, and because the checks on that are fickle.
Without question. Grapes themselves, you obviously are dealing with all sorts of different grapes. You find certain grapes tend to be more stable all the way through the process and to bottling than others, or they all have their little idiosyncrasies?
Well, reds, by the virtue of having tannins, don't have this heat instability problem, because tannins, by definition, adsorb or hook on to proteins. That's by definition. It's a tannin that grabs proteins. Well, whites don't have these tannins, so they have proteins that can become hazy. So that problem is not great for reds. Reds are often kept around long enough that they are cold stable by de facto, I mean, they've just been around in a cool cellar. And no, most people are not going to put a red bottle in a refrigerator.
Most.
But a lot of people are going to put a white bottle in a refrigerator. So those white wines have to be cold stabilized. If they are grape wines, tartaric acid is, they do bad. Tartaric acid and potassium get together when the wine's cold and form crystals, and customers say, I've got this glass in my wine. What's going on? So peach wines, other fruit wines, don't have tartaric acid. It's not an issue. And in general, don't have significant proteins problems. So I'd say grape wines need to be treated carefully and with knowledge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So all these fruit wine makers out there tend to be a little less challenged than...
Well, it turns out peach wines are nasty because they like to be to settle very slowly, and that's still a problem. Most of the other fruit wines are very easy to handle. Peach pear wines, for instance, are easy. Peach wines just aren't quite as fast. Yeah,
yeah,
but they'll do it.
I do an orange and a key lime, and those settle very quickly too. I never have problems with those.
Right. Good.
You know. So it's you know, I can understand. I didn't realize, I've never made peach. Florida's not really noted for their peaches anyway, so.
Yes. I have a client in, guess where, Georgia.
Georgia?
Who's doing it. He's not happy about it. He's going to go to stay with other whites next year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a guy who comes down who has a winery in Georgia, and he consults on a couple of others up there, and he comes down and visits every year, and he brings a bottle or two down for me. He does a great job with his grape wines. I'm really impressed with what he's doing up there.
And good.
So,
good.
Yeah, it's Georgia's got, and I've tasted wines from around the country, and I'm really have to say I'm impressed with what they're doing all over this country.
Absolutely.
Phenomenal wines being turned out around this country.
Right. There were times when tasting wines in New York State was really scary, and tasting wines in Kentucky was scary. I'm not afraid to go into any Kentucky winery anymore. I got here in 05, and it was like disaster. And I think we've come a long way. And when I got to New York in 82, they had a big meeting at I won't name it. It's a girls' college, and they had a long set of tables and probably 250 wines. I think there were three I wanted to taste again. So we're away from that. We're not doing that anymore. Now I'd be surprised to find three that I didn't like.
Yeah, and it's the ability of states that we don't think about too of making the wines. I've talked to quite a few states around this country, and some of the wines that they're making and the metals, the golds and all this they're making in competitions that they're entering in is a good testament to the fact that they are making something that is, recognizably good. And it's just absolutely amazing. Things like, Maryland itself has like 43 wineries, and they're doing some great wines out of there. And,
Sure.
I can just go on and talk about a whole bunch of different states we've talked to. And I think it's the fact that people are starting to realize that it's not something that they have to battle, and it's not something that they need to be afraid of. It's something that can jump in there, and they've got people like you who they can call and help through situations that they're not sure about. And that's a big plus, too.
And one of the progress points we've made is to give up planting Chardonnay where it will die and plant something that will grow.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of good things that will grow in the colder climate that are not Chardonnay. Well, okay.
And that's a very good point, too, because a lot of people we've talked to have told us about grapes that they've tried to plant, and they said, and we realized this is not going to grow here, so now we have contacted Cornell or University of Minnesota, and we've gotten plants and grapes that will grow here, and we're doing a great job with them. And I think a part of this is, too, that you can look at places like Cornell and University of Minnesota, which are the two big ones now for making cold-weather grapes, and the research that they're doing and what they're doing now is getting those to the people out there, and they're making some decent wines from these hybrids that they're coming up with.
Yeah, yeah. And the word hybrid no longer has a terrible connotation anymore, I think.
Unless you're in California. We were just talking about GMOs. Kentucky wines. Now, I have to say, I've had Kentucky wines. I've had an opportunity to travel around actually northern and central Kentucky and taste some of the wines there. And I'm really quite impressed. I'm impressed with the way the state has helped the wineries. I tell people you can drive down the interstate and see a sign that says such and such a winery, and it will guide you right to their front door with signage as you're going into it.
I think that's real important. And they did not want to do that. In fact, 2 years ago, they had blew their whole budget, and wineries could not get a sign up, even if the winery would pay for it.
Really?
And I thought, that's crazy. But I think that I've seen enough signs recently that some purse strings have loosened up on that, because it really makes sense. You can't sell wine and boost people's interest in the state if you can't find the winery. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's just something that I thought was absolutely great about Kentucky and the fact that, you know, they'd be behind it. Someone told me, in fact, someone in Ohio told me that Kentucky put it to a vote a few years ago, the people there, and it said, we can't survive with the tobacco farms and we need to do something else. If we tear out the tobacco and put in grapevines, will you support the wineries? And people basically said, yes, that's not a problem.
I think that happened before I got here.
Somebody
by the time I got here, it was de facto, right?
And it's funny, though, you walk into any winery in Kentucky, and they greet you by saying, hello, we used to be a tobacco farm, now we're a winery. And
Very often.
Yeah, that's usually
the irony is that the skill required to grow a good grape for wine is quite different from the skills required to grow good tobacco.
Good point.
I'm being very careful not to point anybody's finger at anybody, but they're different. They're really different skills. And we have a lot of little vineyards, you know, guys have a day job. And the problem with the little vineyard is you have a day job and you need to spray on Tuesday and you can't. Thursday, you don't have a crop.
Yeah.
So we've seen some of that. So these people need to either get somebody lined up to take care of their spraying or something. But
Well, there's a cottage industry for anyone listening to the program. Get yourself together, you know, a truck with sprays and pruning and everything else, and go around to these small wineries in Kentucky and Tennessee and all that, and you know, you can keep yourself involved in the wine industry and also help out everybody by doing something like that. So that might be a good little startup job for someone.
The portable bottling lines work on Long Island and in Virginia, but I haven't seen anybody come out of the woodwork here in Kentucky or adjacent states as a portable bottling line where it'll drive up and take your wine and put it in bottles and give you back the bottles. Yeah,
you're right. All set.
That would help
go.
A lot of people. Yeah.
You know, and that's,
go ahead.
No, I just want to say, and it's Georgia. I saw one that started up in Georgia also, and it's a good deal. People.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It helps helps the winery and gets it into the bottles when they need it and all that, and you know, it's something else.
And
but this, you know,
this high-end bottling line can have a sterile filter, 0.45 micron filter, membrane filter that catches any bugs bigger than 0.45 microns, which is
right.
The only ones that you're going to worry about. And they can also have a sterile environment to do it in, whereas a average small winery can't afford that.
So, right. And most of the average small wineries are battling during the thing with Brett and everything else when they're bottling, and so
that's another battle that I think we're winning. I some people think I'm oversensitive, but I know they can screw up good wine if they don't get on top of it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and now easy. It just people don't realize. I mean, everybody looks at the wineries, and I tell people, I said, when we start to bottle, we spend the first whole day cleaning, and then the second whole day we clean, and then the third day we clean, and the fourth day we clean, and the fifth day we start bottling. Because it really is that much of a requirement to be sure everything is ready, and because there's so many things that could cause a problem.
You got it. Yeah. Well, that's the right attitude. I've seen wineries struggle with just yeast getting into their sweetened wines, and that's why I believe in sorbate. You can handle a little yeast, but you better not have any Brettanomyces and some other things in there without that you could take out with a 0.45 filter.
Yeast can't get out of
the air, and the bottles will pick it up as they come by the bottle, the filler, and that's too much, right?
Yeah, and 0.45 is smaller than blood cells, people. If you just get an idea, I mean, 0.45 is really pretty small.
Pretty tiny.
Yeah. 0.45 micron is really small, and I mean anything larger than that, you can get bacteria in there. So it's something we have to all worry about in the business and doing that stuff. We've talked about wines that you've helped. We talked about stuff. For myself and for our listeners, give some wine suggestions that you particularly find enjoyable and reasonably priced around the country, and ones that you like to open and have on the table for yourself.
I don't want to put this down, but I am in the habit of not doing that. I have people come up to me all the time and say, "Oh, what's your favorite wine here in Kentucky?" And my answer is the wine in my glass. But
well,
I don't want to promote one winery over another, either in Kentucky or somewhere else. And it's just kind of unfair to do a hip shot thing and say, "Oh yeah, Charlie's Winery really does good stuff." We have some wineries I think that are top notch here, but I don't think it's appropriate to ID them on the radio, so I won't.
Okay. Well, that's completely understandable. I would probably do the same thing too. People always ask me, "What's your favorite wine?" And I usually respond the same way as you do. They all have a reason for what you're doing with them, and so those reasons will vary depending on the situation. So there's no favorite. It depends on how and when you're going to enjoy them. So
that's right. That's right.
And that is really the key more than anything.
I had some red wine with salmon tonight. Well, I know that's a no-no, but
not
it
really.
Worked.
It worked, yeah. Well, it's the balance is really what you're looking at. That's why I tried to emphasize to people when you're having wine and food, it's the balance. I tell people, pasta, well, that's a trick question. If you have pasta with a light oil on it, then you're going to want a light white wine, maybe a rosé. But if that pasta is covered with a heavy meat and garlic sauce, then you're looking at a heavier wine. You want that balance.
Sure.
And so,
sure. And that's exactly right, yeah.
The old red with meat and white with fish and fowl is I tell people, buy any wine with any wine. It doesn't make any difference as long as you buy my wine. Just pick up a bunch of my wine. Drink it with anything.
Well, again, it's up to people to experiment. And if they like a red wine with salmon, they should have it. And if they want a Riesling with beef, that's fine.
Yeah, if they're not, if they don't mind the taste of the two of them, and they enjoy the combinations, then go for it. That's really what it all boils down to. Any other last thoughts?
Let's see. Alcohol is a problem on the highway. Oh, an interesting statistic. It is more dangerous to walk drunk than to drive drunk per mile.
Really?
Eight times more dangerous to walk drunk than to drive drunk per mile. It's because you can go a lot of miles driving drunk and not so many when you're walking drunk, I think. I thought that was, people need to know that. The other thing people need to know is if you've had some wine or brandy or any drink, you should, before you go in the car, make sure you're okay. If you are in an area where they stop people a lot, rinse your mouth out with water because the alcohol in your mouth will blow away their breathalyzer. So have a drink of water or rinse your mouth out or whatever before you get in the car.
And we do not advocate drug or drinking and driving, but...
That's correct. But people do. Yeah.
But people do. Yeah. 8 times more dangerous to walk drunk than drive drunk.
Yes, you got it.
That
comes out of Freakonomics, in case you wondered. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us tonight.
You can tell I didn't have any fun, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate it very much, and I enjoyed it, and I hope your listeners did too.
Well, I'm sure they did. It was a great conversation, and we wish the best of luck to you and yours, and have yourself a great holiday season, and
thank you.
Maybe sometime we can get you on the program again in the future.
Well, I do have a client in Florida, and if I need to come down there, you're in trouble, right?
Oh, what, may I ask who?
Well, not on the air.
All right. Well, let's. I'm gonna put us both into the room. Everyone will be back in a second. I'm gonna play some background music. I'm gonna find out who his client is. So let's.
Okay.
Up here with the people then.
Oh.
Okay, there you are. Okay, we're back.
All right.
So, that's cool. I can do that. I like that. So, well, again, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the program tonight. We really appreciate it. It was a great show, and maybe sometime in the future here, I might see you walk through the door at the winery, or if not, maybe we can get you back on the program again.
It was my treat. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Have yourself a good evening now. Thanks a lot.
You too. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And there goes Tom. Fantastic. What a nice program. That was very enjoyable. It was a great show. It was a lot of fun. And I don't know, he might still be sitting there. No, he's gone. So we found out some stuff about different things, a little bit more technical talk on a few things there. But some of you home winemakers out there, there's some things to keep in mind. He told us some stuff there. You can always go back and listen to that if you missed it. It was some good technical stuff, some good ideas, and some good advice there. We're going to be on next week. I'm not sure who our guest is going to be. I'm working on a couple of things here. The next program will be the 6th of December. We're getting into the holiday season big time here. We've got all sorts of Hanukkah begins a couple days after that. We got the New Year. We got Kwanzaa at the end of the month. We got Christmas. There's all sorts of things happening in December. So maybe we can... talk about some holiday wines and stuff like that, because the country's full of holiday wines and things that they bring out. And we'll let you know. You can always get in touch with us on the Facebook page or through the email. The email is allaboutwine101@gmail.com. That's all about wine, the number 101@gmail.com. If you have any comments, any suggestions, anything you'd like me to discuss on the program, get in touch with me. By all means, let me know, and we'll try to do it. Also, you can get a hold of Facebook. Join us on Facebook. If you are not a fan of Facebook, you can like us on Facebook because they don't have a love button. And we're at Facebook All About Wine. And we just keep you informed of who's coming on the show and different things there. And you can also get in touch with us at the winery stuff. When I close it out here, all the information will be there. No festival this weekend. But if you are in the area coming up on December the 8th, this is a couple weeks away, actually a week from this Saturday away. If you're in the area, on December the 8th, we are having our 11th birthday party. Yay! Pretty good. 11 years in this economy. We're thrilled. We're happy. We're looking forward to it. We will have birthday cake. We will have door prizes or presents, since it's a birthday, it's going to be presents, not door prizes. We will have Cabot Cheese. They are helping us with our celebration. They are. We'll be tasting Cabot Cheese, and we'll have Cabot Cheese door prizes and stuff like that to hand out. We'll have vendors, entertainment, all sorts of stuff going on that day. So come on out. We are pet-friendly. We are also children-friendly. So you can bring the pets or the kids out and come out and taste some wines and buy some wines and enjoy our birthday party with us. We will look forward to seeing you then. Comments or anything, by all means, let me know. And any comments you want to pass on to Tom, I will be happy to pass on to him if you have any questions. Or any of you home winemakers out there, I don't know what his fees are or how he works with people or what he does. But if you want to get a hold of Tom with stuff, then get a hold of me. I will be more than happy to pass it on to him. And that pretty much takes care of our program for tonight. I appreciate you all tuning in. It's great, as always, to see so many listeners out there on archives and live. Mike, not on with us tonight, not feeling well, but we hope he has a good recovery. And he is back with us next week. And so we'll see you all next week. And I guess I should have found the closing before I said goodbye to you, because that would have been a lot better. So have a good week. See you next week.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. A special thanks to our special guests who have appeared on the show, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in and supporting All About Wine. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and like our Facebook page. Go to twitter.com or facebook.com/AllAboutWineBTR. We welcome your comments and questions by email at allaboutwine101@gmail.com. The email address again is allaboutwine101@gmail.com. All About Wine is a weekly program featuring Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery. The winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. From Interstate 75, take exit 285 and go west for approximately 4 miles. Or from US 19, the Suncoast Parkway, and US 41, go east on State Road 52. The winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., for retail sales and wine tasting. Visit the gift shop and enjoy the peaceful setting outside under a large shady canopy of oak trees. Florida Estates Winery is pet friendly, and picnics are welcome. For more information, call area code 813-996-2113. That's area code 813-996-2113. Or visit us on the web at www.floridaestateswines.com. Again, that's floridaestateswines.com. Be sure to subscribe to our informative bi-weekly newsletter. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio.